of technology. It notes that in May of 1844, Morse gave a public demonstration, sending a message from Washington to a train depot in Baltimore. The message read, "What hath God wrought?" There were 23,000 miles of telegraph wire in operation by 1854, MIT reported. Western Union was founded in 1851. In 1866, a cable link connected the United States and Europe. Thanks to machines, data was moving much faster than humans could ever transport it. In Europe, another innovator, Charles Babbage, born the son of a banker in 1791, was developing an early calculating machine at the time that Morse was refining and evangelizing the telegraph. Babbage designed schematics for a programmable computer, something that could process mathematical equations in place of the human mind. He was celebrated at the time for these marvelous concepts, and then, much later, as one of the computer's great pioneers. As the technology evolved, it had almost competing roles. It was simultaneously leading to tools that would make humans so much more powerful, and at the same time, it was making humans seem less powerful, certainly slower than they'd ever been. A boy from the same hometown as modern art master Vincent van Gogh was about to show just how slow. Tilburg is a manufacturing town in North Brabant in the Netherlands, known today as the place van Gogh did his childhood schooling. But in 1818, more than two decades earlier, Tilburg saw the birth of Francis Cornelius Donders. F.C. Donders learned early in his life to pay attention. He had eight older sisters. He would later study attention with unprecedented precision. Like Helmholtz, he developed into a scientist with many interests, though he was known early in his career for ophthalmology and for establishing the first eye hospital in the Netherlands in 1858. In the middle of the 1860s, Donders turned his attention to human reaction time. He came up with an experiment that involved sitting two people in front of a phonautograph. It was an early recording device, patented in 1857 by a Frenchman, that captured the sound and then, through a mechanical arm, transcribed it onto a piece of paper. In Donders' experiment, one participant uttered a syllable, then the other repeated it as quickly as possible. Using the phonautograph, Donders was beginning to measure what he called the timing of the mind and mental action. He set about trying to determine what circumstances led to shorter and longer reaction times. To do so, he employed three simple tests. In one, a person sat in front of a panel of light bulbs and pressed a button when a light went on. In a second, the person faced a slightly more complex task of hitting a specific button corresponding to a specific light. In the third, the person was required to hit a button when one of the lights went on, though this time, if the person failed to do so in a timely manner, the other light would go on. There's a seemingly obvious quality to his conclusions. Simple tasks take shorter time, and that time grows with the complexity and type of process involved. For instance, the reaction time grows if the person must make a choice or engage a particular motor skill, like pressing a specific button. Donders expanded the experiments. He introduced a range of different demands and stimuli, asking lab participants to respond with the left hand or the right, and to discern among and between colors, words, and sounds. He discovered that more complex tasks not only took more time, they introduced a new wrinkle, more error. How quickly could the brain work, and how much information could it take in, and at what speed? Donders built instruments to try to measure what he called the time required for simple mental processes. He was measuring, Dr. Posner explains, the time it takes to have a thought. As you go into the history of the study of attention, the really epic discovery was the speed of mental processing. Donders' writing at the time shows an ebullient quality, such as when he describes the challenges of quantifying mental processing. But will all qualitative treatment of mental processes be out of the question then? By no means. There was also an ominous note to his findings, published in 1868. He wrote, "Distraction during the appearance of the stimulus is always punished with the prolongation of the process," notes a biography published by the Donders Institute for Brain, Cognition, and Behavior in the Netherlands. Meantime, computer technology, such as it was getting more sophisticated. The cutting-edge computer of the period would hardly have been seen as distracting, unless by virtue of its sheer size people couldn't take their eyes off of it. Take, for instance, the Hollerith tabulator. It looked sort of like an upright piano and used punch cards. Thanks to the use of the device in 1890, the calculation of census data at the time fell to 3 years, down from 7, according to the Computer History Museum. At the time, a publication called The Electrical Engineer remarked that the tabulator bested even divine speeds. "This apparatus works unerringly as the mills of the gods, but beats them hollow as to speed," the electrical engineer read, according to a history published by Columbia University. The Hollerith tabulator was the work of Hermann Hollerith, who incorporated the tabulating machine company at the end of the 19th century. Later in 1911, it became the Computing Tabulating Recording Company, which in turn was renamed in 1924 as International Business Machines, or IBM. Modern computing was in its infancy, still used only by corporations and the military or other huge government operations. But in those circles, its power was becoming apparent. On a mostly separate track, there were also major advances in communications technology. Alexander Graham Bell, working on development of a talking telegraph, got essential patents toward his efforts in 1876 and 1877, the year he and partners started the Bell Telephone Company. By 1904, there were 3.3 million telephones in the United States, according to a corporate history published by AT&T. Then, by 1927, transatlantic telephone calls were available using two-way radio technology, with a call costing $75 for 3 minutes. As the 20th century progressed, developments in computing and interpersonal communications technology, which had been evolving somewhat independently, began to converge. It is a powerful union whose significance cannot be understated. The marriage of computers and communications brought so much utility. It also set the stage for a formidable, arguably unprecedented, challenge to the human brain, one that was often unseen and widely underestimated. Put another way, technology was evolving by the day, but the human brain was more or less staying put. By 10 p.m., the gas loft is hopping. The host, enjoying pats on the back and gifts of booze from newcomers, slides through the crowd and sidles up to his girlfriend, who in turn is talking to a man with a 3-day growth, a friendly grin, and a gray fedora. Dan Vickery is the guitarist for the Counting Crows and co-writer of some of the band's big hits. He's just back from tour, his face ruddy from the effects of days on the road. These days, he says, bands make their money from touring, not from putting out music, even hits. That's because the internet has shattered traditional business models and fractured the attention of the audience. So many entertainment options, so little time. While on this latest tour, he explains, he had a cool experience related to technology. In the front row of one of the concerts sat a cherubic man with a white beard. Dan didn't recognize Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of the Apple computer, but he was wowed when later, after the concert, Woz came backstage and asked Dan if he wanted to have dinner sometime, just to hobnob and hang out. "How cool is that?" Dan says. "Look," Dr. Ghazali exclaims. His girlfriend and Dan followed the neuroscientist's gaze to a group of three people standing nearby in the middle of the packed room. One of the three clearly commands the group's focus. He's tall with hair that is both short and unkempt. On his nose sits a pair of odd-looking glasses. They look sort of like slimmed-down, opaque wraparound shades worn by cyclists. "Google glasses, one of 10 pairs in the world." The glasses are not used to help show a person the outside world, but rather a flow of information. When a wearer glances to a spot in the corner of a lens, he or she can scan a data feed to, say, check incoming email. In this case, in late 2012, they are mere prototype, a grand curiosity being worn by another local celeb, Philip Rosedale, the founder of Second Life. After the Google Glass sighting, Ghazali, his girlfriend, and Dan the guitarist each pull out their cell phones. Dr. Ghazali looks up to see the others lost in their own space. That's funny. That's a moment, he observes. He surmises. Each of us was probably going to tweet about it or post the moment on Facebook. Dr. Ghazali says various media outlets have been calling him to ask about the new Google glasses and how they might impact attention. They're distracting, I keep telling them. But, he says, they don't want to hear it. They have an agenda, and they're going to print whatever they want. This is a significant moment. Here, amid the digerati, the elite of the valley, the definition of attention seems to broaden. It is not merely about the cocktail party effect, which demonstrates the power and limitations of our ability to focus. In this setting, amid a cacophony of face-to-face and virtual communications, another key piece falls into place. It has to do with our desires and efforts to capture other people's attention. After all the tweets and Facebook status updates, the emails, YouTube videos, and texts are not creating themselves. We are creating them. They are enabled by technology, sure, but they're driven by the humans pressing the buttons, asking for a tiny piece of the fractured spotlight. In modern life, as at this cocktail party, the noise is not incidental, not a laboratory exercise. It's everywhere, and it's created by someone or many, each with their needs. In fact, the ability for individuals to create and broadcast media explains a key difference between the nature and amount of information people consume today than in past eras. In 2008, people consumed 3 times the amount of information they did in 1960, according to researchers at the University of California at San Diego. And now, the researchers say, 1/3 of the information we consume is interactive, as opposed to passive media like television or radio. In the spring of 2013, a few months after this first Friday party took place, Twitter announced that users were sending 400 million tweets per day. That's up from 340 million per day a year earlier, a 17.6% increase. That's a mere drop in the bucket compared to the number of texts sent. 6 billion in the United States each day. Email adds another 144 billion globally on a daily basis. And don't neglect Facebook, which reported in the summer of 2012 that users were daily posting 2.5 billion pieces of content, status updates, photos, videos, comments, etc. The cascade also spills over into the work world. A typical office worker was getting interrupted by various media stimulation every 3 minutes in 2004, according to research by Gloria Mark, a professor at the University of California at Irvine. That was before the spread of instant messaging and Facebook. By 2013, the interruptions were every 2 minutes. Such intrusions came either from a person responding to a new stimulus, like an incoming email, or from an internal urge to change tasks, say, to write a new email. Dr. Ghazali sees another side effect in that there were so many medical journals popping up online that it was getting hard to keep up with all the new developments and to figure out which were valid and which were not. More journals are coming into existence. It's hard to keep pace with the articles hitting journals. It's almost impossible there's so much of it, he says. He's a full participant, publishing articles, speaking, doing media appearances. Broadly, the challenge of keeping up is a problem of oversaturation. At the Gasloft, Dr. Ghazali attracts the attention of the old-fashioned variety. A beautiful woman with long black hair, dressed in a tight skirt, gives him an adoring eye. Before he peels away to hobnob, he says he has a thought about another way to illustrate the way attention works and how easily it can be fractured in the modern world. He wants to show me about the power of distraction. Through Mickey Hart, he explains, he's met a man named Patrick Martin. Patrick is a magician. He's done magic for heads of state, in addition to Muhammad Ali and Princess Di. Dr. Ghazali says the magician is a master of manipulating attention. In a room in which he is exposed to an audience all around him, 360 degrees, he manages to steer the attention of everyone exactly where he wants it, and away from the thing they think they're trying to focus on, the sleight of hand. Of late, the magician has Dr. Ghazali thinking about distraction. It's not exactly the opposite of attention, but it is an antagonist to attention. As such, Dr. Ghazali thinks the concept of distraction provides a powerful lens through which to view the science of attention. He invites me to join him and the magician for dinner so I can see for myself. Distraction, Dr. Ghazali says, is a powerful weapon. Chapter 8. Terrell. One night, when Terrell Danielson was in the 10th grade, the door swung open in her bedroom. It was midnight, the cusp of another scary and vivid childhood memory. Her dad stood in the doorway again, this time armed with a saxophone. He blew into it, his red cheeks filling it with breath and spittle, creating screeching noises, nothing approximating music. He was beyond drunk, blitzed, filled with fury. "Stop it! We're trying to sleep," she yelled. "You shut your mouth!" He began to parade around the house. Terrell shut her door and put on the record player to shut out the noise. It was a new chapter with a similar theme and a more intense antagonist. At this point, Terrell recalls, Danny had started drinking earlier in the day, every day. He would wait until everyone was asleep, then take out Michael's gold saxophone and start blowing, sometimes for hours. Terrell would hide the saxophone, in the bathtub, a cupboard, her bedroom. Danny would wake her, demand it, berate her, threaten her. Her beatings, for the most part, had stopped. This was the new psychological warfare. Sometimes he'd find the sax. Sometimes she'd get the sleep her body craved, that she knew she needed, even though she wasn't trying to stand out at school, just survive it. Somehow she got A's and B's. In her diary, she graded her days. Most were D's and F's, but there wasn't much to be done about it. Terrell remembers Danny making the stakes clear. If Kathy left, he'd take Mitchell. The threat of him kidnapping Mitchell was constantly held over our heads, Terrell said. The cops were no help. Sometimes Terrell would call them, or a neighbor did, but she felt hopeless, and like Danny, had it covered. He told the officers that it was a family matter. Terrell also felt that Kathy was accusing her of being an instigator. Terrell thought she followed most of the rules. Don't mess up the house, stay outside, and don't answer the phone. She wasn't sure why she wasn't supposed to pick up the phone, but that was the rule. Terrell felt like her mother blamed her for antagonizing Danny and making things worse. And there was the threat of gunplay. Her dad sometimes flashed his Magnum. Terrell remembers him also carrying a brown bag filled with painkillers, which he washed down with vodka. Sometimes, when Danny was wasted, he would tell Terrell and Michael that he wasn't their real father. In the morning, Terrell would ask her mother about it, and Kathy would tell her that Danny was drunk and to ignore him. Terrell knew better than to invite any friends over to the house, but once, she invited the daughter of the bishop at her local church to visit her when Terrell was visiting her maternal grandparents. It was a sleepover, interrupted. In the middle of the night, Danny showed up, hammered, and threatened to take Mitchell. Same old, at least for Terrell. But she looked over and saw the bishop's daughter, Julie, tucked between the edge of the wall and the piano, sobbing. They took her home the next morning, a day earlier than they'd planned, and the girl never spoke to Terrell again. Terrell's first escape hatch had been books. She took a more concrete step when she was 16. She went to a local youth employment program in Downey and got a referral to a mom-and-pop accounting business. It was in a small office plaza in Downey, in a nondescript two-story office building owned by Mark and Millie Mandel. They were an older couple, both CPAs on their second marriages. They had 8 children between them, all grown, all college grads. Terrell earned $2.25 an hour answering phones and filing papers. She bought Mitchell a new pair of sneakers, sometimes a toy. She purchased a dirt-cheap used red Ford Pinto with fake wood paneling. At the firm, she worked quietly, trying to be friendly but invisible, just like at Warren High School, where she tried not to fall asleep conspicuously. She reminisces that she managed a 3.2 GPA at Warren, but that she felt like the trashiest girl in school. In her senior year, Terrell tried out for the cheerleading squad. One night she went over to the house of Nancy Smith and her husband Rich, the family's close friends from way back, and showed off the cheer she was working on. Terrell was so excited. Then, Danny came over and was drunk, or on the pills, and just started ripping into Terrell, telling her she was nothing. He slammed her verbally, up one side and down the other, Nancy remembers. He crushed her like a little bug. Nancy thought that maybe this big drunk went after Terrell because, in his own way, he was intimidated by her. She could outthink him. She was smarter than him, always two steps ahead of him, Nancy recalls. It frustrated Danny that she wouldn't cave in. He couldn't destroy her with words. Nancy remembers that Terrell was the one in the family who would dump out her dad's booze, not Kathy, because she knew what Danny would do if he found an empty bottle or cup. The you-know-what would hit the fan, Nancy said Kathy would tell her. Nancy believes Kathy didn't leave Danny because he did provide for the family financially. When Danny was sober, things were pretty good, Nancy remembers. They never went without. Besides, Kathy was good people, but she didn't have much education to fall back on. It was a different time. Wives just didn't up and leave husbands. Plus, Danny generally would never abuse anyone in public, not physically at least, making it his word against the family's. The cheerleading incident was the rare time when he lashed out while people were watching. He was very shrewd that way, Nancy says. Others saw only mean. Another family friend, Patricia Diane Hauser, says Danny would be drunk by 10 in the morning, yelling, threatening violence. Kathy was a mess so many times at my house, Patricia recounts, and she remembers Danny using Mitchell as a pawn, threatening to take the boy, or refusing to let Kathy take him when she sought escape. Michael, Terrell's older brother, had trouble going against Danny, Patricia recollects. Less so for Terrell. Terrell fought back, Patricia says. She was the fiercest little person. For his part, Mitchell, Terrell's younger brother, remembers things differently, although he was a baby at the time. Looking back years later, he recalls his dad as a great guy. My hero, he says of Danny. Yes, Mitchell says, looking back. There were problems, but he remembers them stemming from marital strife and tension between Kathy and his dad, not any cruelty on the part of his father. In her senior year in high school, Terrell wound up making the cheerleading squad and got two rewards, a royal blue, gold, and white outfit, and along with the library book she voraciously consumed, another escape route. She went to practices in the morning and after school. She was out of the house. She cheered for football and basketball players. She tried to be bubbly. Midway through Terrell's senior year, she says her mom had finally had enough of Danny and went to Norwalk Superior Court to officially get a divorce. She took Terrell with her. Terrell dressed nicely, with a white blouse and a Peter Pan-type collar. She was proud of and pleasantly surprised by her mom's courage. But there was a much bigger surprise waiting in the courtroom. Partway through the hearing, Terrell remembers, the judge asked Kathy, "Does the biological father pay child support for the minor daughter?" He meant Terrell. She says she looked at her mother. "What biological father?" "What biological father?" That was how she found out that Danny wasn't her real dad. Terrell pestered her mother for details but got few. Terrell wasn't told her father's name. She learned only that he'd been a high school sweetheart who was long gone. "He doesn't want you, and he's not interested in being a father," Terrell says Kathy told her. Terrell felt relief that Danny wasn't her blood. He didn't totally define her. But she was angry, too. "There was another man out there who was her father, who didn't care about me." For all that, it wasn't until high school graduation that something happened that hadn't occurred in years. Terrell cried. Sitting in her cap and gown, a sunny day, she let it go. It wasn't sadness exactly. It was determination. "I knew I never wanted to see any of those people again," she says, looking back. "It was one of the only times in my life that I've cried." The trash can held a pile of refuse, and a woman upside down. Dead. Her blood-slick feet stuck out of the top of the garbage. "What is this doing in an advertisement for shoes?" demanded Terrell. She stood on a small stage at Cypress College, her second year there. On the screen behind her was the image of the dead woman. Not a crime scene, a shoe ad. Terrell was doing a command performance for her debate team, arguing about the deleterious impact of violence in advertising. Terrell's high school guidance counselor didn't consider college an option, urging the young woman to go to a trade school. But Terrell found a community college, feeding off encouragement from the Mandels, the family she worked for at the accounting firm, and her own raw faith that she could change her circumstances. She got further encouragement at Cypress from a communication professor named Pat Ganner. She was heavyset, dowdy, strict, seemingly old to Terrell, though she was only in her 30s, and a caring talent scout. "Terrell, what would you think about joining the debate team?" She posed the question not long after Terrell arrived at Cypress, a few months after high school graduation. The professor saw drive and strength in the young woman, the voracious reader with the discipline. Terrell, starved for such encouragement, lapped it up. She stayed for hours in Dr. Gaynor's office, getting help with homework. She spent even more time with the debate team and at tournaments, once arguing in the persuasive category in favor of child support. For the first time, she drew power from her personal experiences. She'd hidden and run from her home life. Now, it was also serving as a source of drive, even inspiration. She told Dr. Gaynor a bit about Danny. The next year, the professor suggested Terrell do her persuasive address on violence and advertising. She leapt into it, finding numerous examples she'd show on the screen during her talks, like the one where the husband led the wife around by a leash, she on all fours like a dog. It was an ad for a department store. Terrell had taken a job at Disneyland as a ride operator. She worked on Space Mountain, proudly wearing the uniform, a red, white, and turquoise polyester jumpsuit. She met lots of young people, many attending college at nearby USC. They joked in the break room, they laughed. As advertised, Disneyland, to Terrell, was the happiest place on earth. Encouraged by Dr. Gaynor and the young people she met from USC, Terrell applied after 2 years at Cypress to a bunch of colleges: George Washington in Georgetown, the University of Kentucky, UCLA, and USC. She got into every one of them, which, still highly uncertain of herself, she silently attributed to the fact she was poor and filling someone's quota. But she was still elated, particularly when the envelope arrived from USC, which was attended by all those happy, privileged kids from Disneyland. At USC, she took a class in criminal psychology, which she thought would fulfill a credit but wound up touching her deeply. She knew well how bad men acted after years of living with Danny. She started thinking about becoming a prosecutor. She took classes at the university's Annenberg School for Communication. It was interesting stuff, but it also felt practical. She might not be able to afford law school, she thought, but she could always make a living doing public relations. She liked having a glass-half-full outlook and was adept at putting a good face on things. She got scholarship money to live in the dorm. Her roommate was a music major, which meant Terrell got to attend music events. She joined the Helenes, the smiling, effervescent greeters at USC sporting events. She told no one about her past, her home life, and they didn't seem to care. She felt safe. The dorm had a guard. She could sleep without keeping one eye open as she had to do at home. Danny, though, would not let her go. Far from it. One late afternoon day in the summer after her first year at USC, her junior year given all her Cypress credits, she took Mitchell to the movies at the Cerritos Mall. Mitchell was now 6 and a sweet little guy. The pair left the theater through the back doors. By now it was dark. In a vivid recounting, Terrell says she didn't see Danny until it was too late. He was standing right next to them, wearing the familiar blue work pants and shirt, literally stinking drunk. "Terrell, say goodbye to your little brother," she recollects him saying. She looked at him. What did he mean? You're never going to see him again. Danny grabbed Mitchell by the arm. No, 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 help! Help! Terrell screamed. She grasped Mitchell by the other arm. She pulled and Danny pulled, and then Danny, so much bigger than Terrell, swung Mitchell away. That's when I lost him. I didn't have a grip on him anymore. Danny grabbed him and ran away and threw him in the truck, and they drove off. Terrell remembers running to her Pinto after the confrontation with Danny. She climbed in. She became paralyzed. Tears poured from her. Hysteria. It was the days before cell phones. She couldn't call her mom. She didn't even know if she should call the police. What could they do? What had they ever done? She sat in the car for a long time. Still hysterical. Crying the way she hadn't in many years, maybe since high school graduation. In that state, she drove home, blind with anger and helplessness. It nearly cost her dearly. She was so consumed that, driving on the highway too fast, she rounded a curve and the Pinto swerved. She lost control, and then at the last second recovered. Danny returned Mitchell unharmed, but another scar was left on Terrell, the seeds of a recurring nightmare. Whenever she slept at home, she'd have it. Her dad taking Mitchell, threatening that Terrell would never see the boy again. And in the nightmare, she never did see her brother again. Mitchell, looking back, remembers the incident differently. He says his dad came to get him because Terrell had him out too late. His dad, Mitchell recalls, never got out of the car and only got upset when Terrell wouldn't hand him over and resisted. She was always mouthy, Mitchell recalls, suggesting Terrell provoke Danny. And he says his dad took him right home that day to Kathy. His memory underscores some differences in how the children saw their parents and the strife. But Mitchell does concede there were family problems, to the point that he says that when he was in third or fourth grade, after his parents split, he asked to live for a year with his babysitter because of the drama. I kind of threw down the gauntlet as much as a little kid can and told them, I don't want to live with either one of you, he recalls. For his part, Michael, Terrell's older brother, remembers the violence starting when he was 5 and Terrell was 4. Danny beat on me until I was 18. And then, one night at the wrecking yard, he was drunk and started to get violent with me, and I pushed him hard. I was a bit bigger by then. He said he was going to go get his gun. I cannot allow that, Mitchell wrote in an email to Terrell, reflecting on their childhood. He wrote that he and Danny got into a terrible fight at the wrecking yard. In another email, he wrote of how Danny would tell him and Terrell he wasn't their father. When he was saying these things, he usually had me slammed up against a wall, yelling in my face with his putrid booze breath. On Thanksgiving Day of Terrell's senior year in college, she recalls that she and Kathy went for a walk on the beach. Kathy had news. Terrell's real father had made contact, along with his new wife. The pair and Kathy had dinner. Kathy showed them pictures of Terrell and Michael. Terrell says Kathy told her that the man was curious about how the kids turned out, but didn't want to be a father to them. Terrell was furious at her mother for showing her picture to a man who didn't want anything to do with her. How was she going to escape this life? It followed her, even in her dreams. Was there a way for the bubbly and optimistic to overcome the terror and loneliness? One thing was for sure. There would be no family for Terrell. No marriage. Earlier in her life, she told her diary that she was going to have a family and get married in the Mormon temple. But she changed her mind. She couldn't risk putting a child through what she had experienced. There was just too much she couldn't control. Chapter 9. Reggie. Trooper Rendlesbacher made plans to do follow-up interviews with Kaiserman the Farrier and with Reggie. A few days after the accident, he called Mary Jane to set something up. It was around 9 in the morning, right before she was going to go out and deliver the day's mail. I don't feel good about doing this without a lawyer, she told Rendlesbacher. She remembers the conversation went sharply south. He started to accuse me about knowing something, she says, looking back. He asked if Reggie was texting at the time of the accident. Mary Jane says she was offended by the substance of the accusation, and by the tone. Trooper Rendlesbacher was awful, she says. I've never been treated so nasty in my life." She sensed a chip on his shoulder. What's with this guy? It rankled Mary Jane because she had such respect for law enforcement. As to substance, she truly believed that the accident had been caused by the weather, hydroplaning. She got off the phone in tears, scared to death. Still, the two of them had managed to set up a tentative plan for a follow-up interview with Reggie. A few days later, Rendlesbacher drove to the Tremonton city offices and met with Kaiserman. The farrier went through detailed drawings of what had happened. He was upset, pained at having been part of the tragedy. Then it was time to meet with Reggie. Rendlesbacher's phone rang. It was an attorney hired by the Shaw family. The lawyer told him that Reggie wouldn't be coming for an interview and that he, the lawyer, would answer all questions. Rendlesbacher was irritated. He remembers thinking of Reggie. He's lawyered up, and he's not going to say anything. He's got something to hide. Mary Jane opened the bedroom door. Reggie was right there on the bed where she had left him, facing the wall, his phone on the bed behind him. "Reggie." He half turned. It had been another restless night. He kept replaying the accident, thinking about the two dead men and their families, worrying what might happen next. His mom sat on the bed. "I think you should go talk to someone." He knew what she had in mind. A counselor named Galen White had an office just a few blocks away, behind the office of Russell White, Galen's husband, Reggie's dentist, and a local church leader. "No. Just to get things off your chest, Reg." Something was obviously wrong. 2 days after the wreck, and Reggie had barely left his room, hadn't left the house at all, and she didn't know the extent of his emotions. "I felt like I didn't deserve to go out there and live," he says. "Not in a suicidal sense, in the sense that I didn't deserve to enjoy my life. Not when those two men in the other car had no life to enjoy." Mary Jane left. Reggie thought, "Crazy people go get help. Not sane people. Not guys. Not athletes. Not in Tremonton." If you've seen Friday Night Lights, that was us. Same kind of place, same kind of problems, says Dallas Miller, Reggie's best friend. The jocks held sway, but the focus on sports, the All-American veneer, had a dark underbelly, at least from Dallas's perspective. A lot of drinking, weekend nights down in Keystone Beer in the foothills, sometimes driving home drunk, a lot of premarital sex and a lot of pregnancy. Not to put a bad rap on our town, but more often than not everyone on the sports team was living their religion. It was far from everyone's view. In Dallas's case, he felt he was in a better position to see past the town's facade. A rebel from his earliest days, he rejected the church, thinking it a place for hypocrites who didn't live the life they preached. At odds with his parents, he spent many nights on Reggie's floor, sometimes passed out from too much drinking. In fact, there was a decent chance he could have been the one who wound up involved in something tragic. But Reggie? When Dallas heard about it, he thought, he was the last guy I'd have expected this to happen to. He was the kid who always made the right choices, who always did the right thing. Reggie could cool Dallas off. In January of their senior year in high school, Dallas, 6'2" and 205 pounds, threw the ball in someone's face during basketball practice, hitting his teammate in the head. The two squared off and a fistfight seemed imminent. "Reggie grabbed me and threw me in the locker room. We had a long talk," Dallas recalls. He adds, "Reggie was the only person I took advice from. He was a listener. And after he did the listening part, he would have something to say that was probably in my best interest." Certainly not the kind of person who would make a bad decision and kill two men. It must have been just a horrible accident, Dallas figured. No one in the wrong, but a tragedy nonetheless. I was the wild one. He was the mild one. The good listener. Reggie's first and deepest rival was his older brother, Nick. People thought Reggie and Nick were twins. Reggie was big for his age and Nick small. Sometimes they thought Reggie was actually older. They competed at everything, stoked by a culture of competition. I used to make them fight for crackers when I babysat, says older brother Phil, mostly joking. Only the winner got to eat. They played basketball and baseball outside and football video games in the house, sitting on the floor or couch with controllers in their hands. They got their first console, a Nintendo Entertainment System, for Christmas in the early 1990s. It was a square gray box with rectangular controllers that featured a few simple buttons. They went at it at Tecmo Super Bowl, a football game. Reggie was little more than 5 years old. Several years later, the brothers moved on to a different console, the Sega Genesis. It used a 16-bit processor, which allowed double the processing capability of the 8-bit Nintendo, an early sign that the power of these machines would soar with each generation. Better graphics and sound, more complex challenges and on-screen data to juggle. They graduated to Super Nintendo, also a 16-bit system, and Mario Kart, a racing game. A friend of Phil's named Ryan was living in a one-bedroom apartment nearby. On summer mornings, Ryan would knock on the back door and get Nick and Reggie out of bed to play Mario. We'd play for hours and hours, and if we had baseball or football, we'd take a break and go practice and then come home and play again, Reggie remembers. When it came to technology, Reggie had come of age in an extraordinary time. Just a few years before he was born in 1983, Time magazine did a twist on its Person of the Year feature, and instead named the personal computer its Machine of the Year. The cover heralded, "The computer moves in." Reggie's own adoption of technology very much paralleled what was happening around the country, a phenomenon documented in a series of pioneering studies initiated by the Kaiser Family Foundation in 1999. They show an explosion in use of media by young people. In the first study, 1999, Kaiser found that the average child spent 5 hours and 29 minutes using media per day. Within the average, older children ages 8 to 18 spent nearly double the time with media than toddlers. Boys spent slightly more time than girls, and minorities slightly more than whites. In 1999, television was the media that got most of the attention, at about 2 hours and 45 minutes per day, compared to 85 minutes listening to music, tape, CDs, or the radio, and 44 minutes reading or being read to. At that point, only about 21 minutes were spent using the computer for fun, and 20 minutes on video games. There was virtually no internet use. The second study, in 2004, showed big change. There was massive access to new kinds of media that hadn't existed in the mainstream just 5 years earlier. Take instant messaging, which the 2004 report found to be in 60% of homes with children, but that hadn't been in virtually any home 5 years earlier. That second report found that 74% of homes had internet, up from 47% in 1999. The 2004 report found that about 40% of children age 8 to 18 had a cell phone, most on the upper end of that age range. There wasn't even a baseline from the previous study, given the low use of cell phones at the turn of the century. The third report in 2009 showed another leap in media use by young people. The average 8 to 18-year-old was consuming 10 hours and 45 minutes of media per day. How? How was it possible to use almost as much media as there were waking hours? The answer? Multitasking. The study found that the typical person in that age group spent about 7.5 hours using entertainment media, but that a good chunk of that was spent multitasking, using more than one source of media at a time, and those hours were double counted by the researchers. Their attention was divided a good chunk of the day, even within the media space. The researchers found the change owed in large part to access by children of personal devices like iPods and cell phones. About 66% of 8 to 18-year-olds had cell phones, not quite double the percent from the study 5 years earlier. Of note, the new media appeared to be taking time from the biggest screen draw of them all, television. The study found that children's viewing of traditional television had fallen 25 minutes per day from 2004. But a look deeper shows a catch. Kids were now accessing television programming on computers, including phones, the internet, and other gadgets. As a result, overall consumption of television content actually grew. By now, children were watching 4.5 hours of television programming a day, up from 3 hours and 50 minutes in the previous study. and by 2009, roughly an hour of video consumption was done on a device other than the TV. There was a fascinating omission from the 2009 report. It did not include texting or talking on the cell phone in its definition of media use. That was extra. On average, the report found, the average high schoolers texted for an hour and 35 minutes each day. They were doing that in addition to the other media and tasks. They and others were doing it while driving. In 2007, a survey by Nationwide Insurance found that 73% of people reported talking on a cell phone while driving, with teen drivers showing the highest use of any demographic. While Reggie came of age, teen media use soared, and multitasking with it. Reggie didn't need technology to be social. He was plenty social, but in a quiet way. He didn't demand attention, but everyone liked him, including the girls. He spent a lot of his waking hours thinking about them. The first one he really lost it for was Cammy. He met her through a friend, and the chemistry was powerful. But his friends and family weren't so sure about the whole thing. At first, for instance, Dallas didn't like Cammy. It bummed Dallas out that Reggie spent less time with him than with this tall brunette, whom Dallas thought was just okay and reasonably pretty. But Reggie and Cammy would be locked at the hip and the lips. Some light public smooching, sitting on the couch holding hands. Then, Dallas came to appreciate the fact Reggie was so into someone who seemed so into him. I was a jerk to her at first, but she was a real sweet girl. Reggie's mom felt otherwise. Everyone in town knew she didn't like Cammy, Dallas says of Mary Jane. She didn't want her son being serious and being stuck in town. Mary Jane makes no bones about it. She was darling to look at, but she had no personality whatsoever, Mary Jane says, pulling no punches. She was awful. The reason for this strong reaction? Mary Jane believed Cammy was a roadblock to Reggie going on a mission. To Mary Jane, the young woman was putting her passions and wants ahead of Reggie's dream. Valid or not, Mary Jane's conspiracy theories underscored how invested the family was in Reggie's mission, something he professed to want so badly himself. After high school graduation, Reggie went to a year of college in Virginia and to play basketball. He was good enough to make the team, but not good enough to get a scholarship. Ed doubted if Reggie knew it, but the family paid the tuition in no small part because they wanted him to get away from Cammy. Yes, the family wanted Reggie to fall in love and get married and have a family, but the mission came first, and everything would follow. At Virginia, Reggie had a good time and was a decent student. He developed some confidence and a better jump shot. In May, the semester over, he came home to go on his mission. In June, just a few months before the accident, Lisa and Van Park attended his farewell at the Garland Tabernacle, a modest red brick church with spires on each side. Inside, dark wood pews beneath cylindrical lights hung from the ceiling. Reggie gave a brief talk. Afterward, the group went back to the Shaw's house and had a quick celebratory lunch. Then, later that day, Reggie went over to visit the Parks at their two-story, five-bedroom house just a block from the high school. They sat outside, and the Parks gave their well wishes to a boy who they imagined was the kind of kid they wouldn't mind seeing their daughter with. "I was so excited for him to go to Canada," Lisa reflects. Just a few days later, Reggie returned home, ashamed. "Knowing him, I'd have thought, he's just got to clear some things up. He'll get it together and he'll just go back," Lisa says. "I never felt, what a disappointment. If you're Christian in your heart, that's not how you act." Then, September 22nd came around. That night, Lisa heard about the wreck from Van. But the intensity and the severity of things didn't quite hit until a few days later, when she paid her regular visit to a small nail salon in Tremonton. The woman who gave Lisa her clear polish and French tip was Chantel Gubelli, who was married to the brother of Cammy. "Can you believe what happened to Reggie?" Lisa recalls Chantel asking her. The more Chantel told Lisa about the accident, the more Lisa's heart broke. "It must have been the road conditions, or some freak accident. It couldn't have been Reggie's fault. He's more mature than that. He's more responsible than that." She told me about the families of the men who'd been killed, Lisa says. I remember thinking, there may not be a chance for them to forgive him. Chapter 10. Reggie. Mid-morning, 3 days after the accident, Reggie walked out of the house for the first time. It had just snowed. Reggie thought, it is so bright out here. He put the keys into the ignition of the Chevy. He drove alone. Every car that went by was a terror, a potential fatality. Something just clicked. He'd see the counselor after all. Up the stairs he found the office of Galen White, the counselor his mother had asked him to see. Reggie had relented. The office was small, with a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf along one wall. Galen sat behind her desk, a simple thing with a laptop on it. He took a seat in one of the chairs in front of the desk. Galen noticed in particular Reggie's sad eyes. She'd known him a long time, and he always had sad-looking eyes, she thought, even though he was an easygoing, happy person. Now there was nothing playful beneath the sad eyes. She knew about the accident, of course. She wanted to hear his telling of it. He started by telling her about the morning of the accident, how his mom had gotten him out of bed because he'd slept through his alarm. By then he was crying, sobbing, pulling at the box of Kleenex on Galen's desk. It was bothering him, killing him. He knew the story's terrible ending, of course, but a lot of the details were missing. He couldn't picture what happened. He told her about driving the SUV over a hill and then going down the other side. The weather was bad. I crossed the center line just a little bit, and I hit the car. He was sobbing. Reggie, why do you think you can't remember what happened? He shrugged. He thought, because the details aren't important to me. What really matters is that those two men are dead, and what are their families going to do now? Galen listened and typed notes into her laptop. She tried, as always, to keep her typing unobtrusive so Reggie wouldn't get distracted. But she was typing even less than usual. That's because she realized early on in the conversation that she ought to keep the notes modest, in case there were legal implications should Reggie eventually face charges. Even recognizing there was doctor-patient confidentiality, she wanted to be careful about what she put on paper. She asked Reggie why he thought he was having trouble remembering what happened at the time of the accident. He didn't know. She posited, "You probably went into shock. That's why you're not remembering." Reggie nodded. It sounded right. "I can't believe I could do something like this." He couldn't remember. It had just been an accident, right? So why did he feel like he'd done something so wrong? Galen gave Reggie some tasks. Exercise, write in a journal, meditate. She said they should meet again, and he agreed. She told him he should start writing letters to the families of Keith and Jim, not necessarily to send them, but just to express himself. And so he went back to his room and started writing. Letters and letters to the families of Jim and Keith. They read over and over again, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." After the session, Galen couldn't help but think about the larger picture of Reggie's life. He'd just returned, under difficult circumstances, from his mission. Not that she judged him, but she also understood that Reggie might not feel that way, that he might be carrying a heavy weight of feeling like he'd let down himself and his family and his community. "I can't imagine having to come home," she says of the idea of returning from a mission early, and under a cloud. She says she wonders whether people who came home prematurely might be better off living somewhere else for a while, so they would not have to deal with feeling judged. "I'm amazed people come home to the community. I don't know how you go home to the community." 10 days later, on October 5th, Reggie returned to Galen. This time he told her he was feeling better. He was acting like he was doing okay, she recalls. He exhibited less anxiety. Her notes, released with Reggie's permission, read, He reports some ruminating and wishing more than anything else he had not been on the road at that moment. Galen wasn't particularly buying that Reggie's mind had calmed or his anxiety and even depression had lifted. She suspected that Reggie was aware that the $65 an hour fee she charged, there was no insurance for her visits, could be a hardship on his family. Reggie, she thought, hated to displease people, particularly his family. There were so many pressures on him, not to let his family down, particularly after the mission return, and not to compound whatever shame he perceived they felt by him getting in trouble with the law, going to jail, or whatever might happen. Galen talked to him about understanding that the past is a path that is behind us, not the path we are destined to take in the future. Of course, she felt strongly she should see him again, but doubted she would. She let her mind connect dots between the accident and his failed mission. She wasn't sure of the details, but she could surmise that he told someone at the mission training center in Provo that he'd done something inappropriate in the lead-up to the mission. That much was commendable, she thought. Ultimately, he had told the truth. But if he'd gotten to the training center in the first place, it surely meant that somewhere along the line, he'd probably lied. He'd had to have told someone he didn't have any problems, such as premarital sex, to bar his place on the mission. And so, Galen was left wondering whether Reggie was sincerely traumatized by the accident and therefore couldn't remember what had happened, or whether there was something more insidious occurring. I was wondering whether or not his sense of conflict about the accident was genuine confusion or another lie. She was right about the mission. Reggie had lied several times in the lead-up to his mission. He had lied to his bishop about having sex. His lies weren't particularly big or unusual. After all, it's not uncommon for young people to lie to parents or a pastor about their having premarital sex. And they tell those lies even when there isn't the intense cultural pressure that Reggie felt as part of a small Mormon community. The very language used by people in Tremonton betrayed just how intense that pressure was. Mary Jane feared a disgrace when Reggie came home. Galen even wondered about how people come home after a failed mission. The environment explains how Reggie could have felt himself in a fishbowl or crucible, how he'd put his family in a bad light. What Galen was wondering as Reggie sat in her office was whether the first failed mission had upped the stakes for Reggie. He'd already felt he let his family down once. Now, so soon after coming home, he was behind the wheel during a deadly wreck. What if he'd done something wrong? How could this young man sustain another disappointment? And Galen didn't know the full story. Just how the lies tortured Reggie and left him questioning how he behaved when forced to confront difficult truths. During Thanksgiving break of Reggie's freshman year in Virginia, he came back to Tremonton to see the family, Cammy, and his bishop, David Lasley, who lived just down the street from the Shaws. The bishop is an important job, but perhaps not as significant as the term bishop might communicate to people of other faiths. The bishop is a lay leader for the local ward, which is one of the small but critical parts of the highly organized and hierarchical Mormon structure. Each ward has about 500 people, and roughly 10 wards make up a stake, which has a president. Reggie set up a meeting to talk to Bishop Lasley about going on a mission, Reggie's lifelong dream. In a modest office, the bishop asked Reggie about his interests, passions, and intentions. He also asked if Reggie had violated any tenets, like having recent premarital sex. Reggie assured him that he had not. It was the truth, but not for long. A few weeks later, Reggie came home again for the Christmas break. One afternoon, he found himself at Cammy's house. They'd been talking about this moment lately. They went to her bedroom, her queen-sized bed. She told him she loved him. He told her that he loved her too. The first time he'd said that to her, to anyone. They did it. It was good. It was fun. I was 19, and there's only one thing that really seemed important. Love or sex? Probably sex, Reggie says, looking back. I thought it was love. But thinking back, lust and love, they seemed awfully close to each other at the time. And commingled with them was guilt. A few days after he lost his virginity, he went, as always, to church. He couldn't pray. I tried my best to act like it was a normal Sunday and go into church, but it didn't feel right. I didn't belong. A few days later, Reggie went back to the bishop's office for a follow-up meeting. "Things still good on the girl front?" Bishop Lasley asked. "We're good. Everything's good," Reggie said. He tried to look the bishop right in the eye. A few hours later, he saw Cammy. She asked, "Did you tell him?"
Yeah.
"I told him." He explained to Cammy that the bishop said Reggie could get a one-time exception. "He thinks that I'll be okay and I'll be able to go, as long as we're good and as long as we've stopped." He'd lied to Cammy, too. He was afraid if he told her the truth, she might tell the bishop or someone, thus ensuring he would stay home and be with her and not go on a mission. She didn't want me to go. She wanted me to stay home and get married. Back in the office with Galen, the counselor, the issue didn't come up, but it was weighing heavily on Reggie, and hadn't stopped weighing on him for many months. He felt in some way that it was a kind of original sin, a terrible thing he'd done that spoke to a dark thing inside of him. It was a big point in my life, and I chose to look people square in the eye and lie about it. In between his meetings with Galen, on September 28th, Reggie left the house a second time. He had a midday appointment to see John Bunderson, a lawyer who Reggie's dad, Ed, had gotten a referral for. Bunderson had an office 20 minutes away in Brigham City, where Ed worked in a machine shop. Mary Jane drove Reggie from Tremonton, and they picked up Reggie's dad at the Brigham Implement Company. Ed's employer sold farm equipment, but also had a machine shop that he managed for nearly a decade, helping building it up into a substantial operation that did metal fabrication, built parts for airplane jetways and automobile airbags, and took on odd jobs, like fixing a bicycle or making parts for an irrigation ditch. It was blue-collar all the way, located inside a corrugated metal shell. Metal shavings covered the floor around the heavy equipment, which filled the shop with a regular hum. Out front were a line of loaders and tractors waiting to be repaired, but you could hardly beat the shop setting. If you looked west, beyond nearby Brigham City, the Rockies dramatically exploded toward the sky. The family drove to Bunderson's office. It was located in a single-story building near the county courthouse. It was unassuming to the point of being ugly, with a pink, unkept exterior and a mass-manufactured mailbox.